We're with you this afternoon on the panel. International, Wallace Chapman here, Lila Haru with me, former Minister and Trade Unionist, now working for UnionAid, and David Farrer, editor of Kiwi Blog and on the Taxpayers Union Board. This first, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has spoken to media this afternoon after the Ministry of Health reported a worker at Auckland Airport has tested positive for COVID-19.
So this is an individual who boards planes to clean them after they've come from places where there is COVID, carrying passengers with COVID. So a very clear link at this stage to cases that are high risk.
However, the Prime Minister also confirmed the border worker with COVID-19 was someone who was fully vaccinated. They were last tested on the 12th and then the 19th. Most recent test is where it was picked up. COVID modeller Professor Michael Plank is with us to share his thoughts on this development. Professor Plank, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Can you explain to us just how this person got COVID if they were fully vaccinated?
Well, really, I think this case is a reminder that vaccines, although they're very, very good, no vaccine is perfect. And in particular, it's possible that the vaccine prevents people from getting seriously ill, but that they could still get infected and only have mild symptoms or maybe even be completely asymptomatic. And so it's quite possible that that's what's happened in this case. It remains to be seen whether the person has symptoms or not. But the vaccine's quite likely to prevent them from getting seriously ill, but they could still become infected.
Yeah, I mean, just as really a reminder, we spoke with Dr. Nikki Turner on the panel last week, who said that, you know, even fully vaccinated people can still carry the virus in their throats and therefore potentially spread it. As a reminder, that when borders open, there will always be the situation. Is this a reminder or a case of that, perhaps?
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, vaccines, the vaccine will reduce the likelihood of that happening. So it will reduce transmission from people who've been vaccinated. But as I say, no vaccine is perfect. And so there will still be some cases where that does happen.
So there is always going to be a risk. That's just the nature of the beast with this.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, the other thing this case shows is that it's absolutely crucial that we keep up the routine testing of all our border workers, because, of course, the rest of the population at this stage is mostly unvaccinated. And so it's really important we keep the virus out of the community. And so if we don't test border workers like this one, there's a risk that they could spread the virus to others in the community. So testing continues to be crucial.
Any thoughts on this, Lila?
Yeah, I thought that the Prime Minister's framing in her comments today was pretty interesting. So she was preparing us for kind of the end of the elimination phase, that once we've been vaccinated, you know, across the country, the whole population, or as many of us who will agree to do so, that the aim is to manage a resurgence or the pressure on the health system as a result of vaccination. So I thought that was an interesting sort of subtle shift in messaging, really, from her, that we're moving towards, you know, managing through vaccination the presence of the virus in the community, and rather than sort of the current process of needing to have an elimination strategy because we aren't vaccinated.
David?
Well, in terms of the Pfizer vaccine, as I understand it, and our expert will correct us, it reduces, you know, the chance of catching it by around 95%, which is, you know, 19 times less likely. Not 100%, but, you know, still very good. My worry is that cases like this, even though we explain it, will increase vaccine hesitancy. And I've been surprised by how many people I've talked to who are not anti-vaxxers in the normal sense. They get all the childhood ones, but they do say they're not sure about some of these because, you know, they're new, they haven't been tested, they might not work 100%. And the challenge for us is to get that vaccination rate up very high, but also to think, what do we do if we don't get herd immunity, the 70 to 85%? Because even countries like Israel, which have been very advanced, they seem to have sort of tepid out at around 65% of the population vaccinated. So I think we do need to think about what's the strategy going forward. If everyone who wants a vaccine has one, but we still don't have enough to give us immunity.
Would you like to comment on that, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I agree with most of those comments. COVID-19, I don't think it's going to be going away. I think it's going to be circulating around the world for years to come. And so, we can't keep the borders closed forever. So what's essential is that we get the message out that the vaccines are very effective and safe, and that we get as many people as possible vaccinated, so that it really protects our vulnerable people in our population, and it means that the threat from COVID-19 is massively reduced.
Right. Professor Michael Plank, thank you for your time. Appreciate it. 13 past for the panel. By the way, meanwhile, the Prime Minister says the bubble is not at risk. The Productivity Commission has released its findings into what are known as frontier firms, the top 10%. Commission Chair Ganesh Nana said just 30 companies are counted for over half of all exports from this country. The productivity of leading companies in Aotearoa is on average less than half of that found in the top companies in other small advanced economies. And it's said that New Zealand was becoming less competitive, which made it harder to maintain and improve the well-being many want and expect. And he also said many Māori firms could help light the way because they took a long-term perspective and used innovation to manage multiple objectives. With us is Sir Ian Taylor, Ngāti Kahunguru, who heads up animation research, whose graphics are used worldwide, be it America's Cup or Formula One, PGA Golf. And he's just judged the Māori category in the New Zealand High Tech Awards. Tēnā koe tā, Ian.
Hello, Greg. Hello, Wallace. How are you? Kia ora.
Pleasure. Good to have you on. Now, the report said to focus on exporting products that cannot be found elsewhere, which is what you did and do. So how do you view these findings?
I think they're very interesting. I think there's some considerable validity in looking towards Māori business. But, you know, to put this in context, you know, I look at the sort of normal iwi companies and, you know, where they've invested. And I recall a year or so ago being at a Māori investment hui where, you know, one of the major iwis was really stoking up the pride and having raised their assets to $1 billion or plus, which is impressive. But I asked the CFO, you know, how much of that had been put into technology? It looked like the bulk of it was in tourism and hospitality, two industries that actually create low-value jobs for our rangatahi in the future. And when I asked about innovation and technology, his response was they're too risky. And
right.
I think of Kupia jumping in that waka in Hawaii, pushing the waka out and coming across the Pacific Ocean. You know, we are a nation. We are a culture that has taken risks, that have measured the risks. And what is encouraging is that in the Māori awards, we discovered a number of companies that are actually probably more closely aligned to that kind of cultural understanding of business.
Well, Ian, let's bring on the panel. What do you make of this line? I mean, New Zealand's per-person income is stuck at roughly 70% of that enjoyed by countries in the top half of the OECD, and that's endured across multiple governments. How do we get the income up? How do we get more innovation?
Well, don't you feel sometimes that this is a bit like Groundhog Day? You know, I was at the Knowledge Wave conference in 2001. We've been through endless kind of discussions about how to improve productivity. And every single report, including this one or this series of reports, makes it really clear that innovation is not driven by individual firms, individual people, or the state per se, that it takes a whole system of sort of complementary players who are headed together in an innovative direction. So, you know, I often think about the origins of New Zealand's primary sector. And when you look at the, you know, the kind of synchronicity of government regulation, educational institutions, research institutes, marketing and promotion internationally supported by government, as well as all the individual farmers, farm workers, unions, other parts in the sort of private sector of the system, we've actually had a really good living example of how, you know, innovation, which is no longer seen as an innovative agricultural production per se, works when you have all these factors combining. And that's all these reports are saying, is that you need a, you know, you need a design-led system where you have all the components involved in the across the public and private sector. So I didn't feel that excited by the report because I felt like I'd read it a lot of times before.
Yeah, knowledge economy, and like,
when are we
that.
Actually going to get it?
Yeah, Ian?
Well, you know, I guess, I mean, I travel in this area and, you know, I'm surprised. I think we are one of the most innovative countries in the world. I mean, we've got Peter Beck, a guy who has no degrees, no qualifications, and we are one of the only countries in the only country in the Southern Hemisphere that has a space program because of a young guy called Peter Beck who was passionate about making rockets. Take a look at Tuaropaki. Now, I don't know if you've heard of Tuaropaki, the Tuaropaki Trust, but yes, I was at that same Knowledge Wave conference in 2001, and I've never been back to another one because I don't think governments, you know, we just ask governments to get out of the road now. But if you look at the Tuaropaki Trust, that began in 1952. It is an incredibly innovative Māori trust that is in geothermal power, pastoral farming, energy services and engineering, and most people haven't even heard of them. And one of the major things I saw coming through in the Māori Awards, again, we've had them only for 5 years. I mean, think about that. Our people were innovators who used STEM to come across the Pacific Ocean. It took till 5 years ago that we actually got a Māori category in the High Tech Awards, and it has been impressive. This year was the most impressive year I've seen.
Okay. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting we don't have innovators and amazing innovations, but this report is talking about the top 10%, the sort of leading what they call frontier firms within New Zealand, and the fact that that 10% of firms is 50% less productive than the top 10% of firms in similar sized and, you know, types of countries. And, you know, if you're going to get a massive kind of improvement in productivity across the whole of Aotearoa and that, you know, drive some major sectors forward, it is going to take a public, private, community sector approach. And, you know, that's not to knock the innovation that happens without that, but this right. is about actual economy-wide okay. transformation.
David, you've got a comment for Ian.
Well, I think we have to be careful. Productivity and innovation aren't quite the same thing, and we have to be a bit careful what we wish for sometimes. Well, if we take productivity, let's look at McDonald's. They used to employ lots of staff. Now, if you walk into McDonald's, you go up to a kiosk and you punch the buttons and you work out what you want. And actually, as a customer occasionally, I like that because you don't have the pressure of being in the queue, you know, of having to decide on the spot. And so that's good for the customer. It's good for McDonald's because kiosks cost less than people. But it means there's a lot less people employed retail at McDonald's. Probably good for those who are IT designers who are designing the kiosks. But productivity at the end of the day is producing more for the same or less cost. And often human capital is the biggest part of that. So when we talk about we want greater productivity, that often will have huge displacement. People will eventually get jobs elsewhere, but you've got potentially a generation of people finding there's not many jobs for them.
Which is why these reports say that you've got to look at how you develop kind of specialist services and products which are exportable. New Zealand, you know, and we have the same issue as any other smaller country.
Export-led, the likes of Denmark or the Netherlands. Ian, final thoughts?
Yes. So, you know, we have to start looking at the other 50% and their productivity. And, you know, a lot of these people writing these reports are actually out of touch with the speed at which young people are moving today. So let me give you just one example of a young couple who started making crayons out of beeswax 3 years ago. They now have $7 million in sales, and on Amazon, they are the second highest seller of crayons in the world after Crayola.
But who owns Amazon?
Yep, but who owns this company in New Zealand that is using beeswax to make crayons, a small New Zealand company that's just about to build another factory because they can't keep up with orders. I have huge faith in our young people who haven't been cluttered by the kind of speeches and things we heard in 2001. I am surrounded by them here, and I have great faith in our companies moving forward.
All right, lovely to have you on. Ian Taylor, appreciate it, who heads up Animation Research Limited and was named Innovator of the Year in 2019. But you just don't buy it, Lila.
Well, I don't buy the laissez-faire kind of attitude. I mean, yes, of course, there are some stunning, great success stories, but you're telling me that Māori in general are, you know, reaping the benefits of that? You know, we've talked a lot and you talk a lot on this program about, you know, the level of kind of deprivation as well and the difficulties and challenges in these communities. And I don't think pretending that you can just kick the government out and get on with it is a solution to
Quite a bit of response to this. Your thoughts on that, most welcome. 2101 is the number to text. 24 past four, David Farrer, Lila Haro with me today. Research reveals the chances of the Alpine Fault generating damaging earthquake in the next 50 years are much higher than previously thought. And it shows a 75% chance of the Alpine Fault rupturing before 2068, up from around 30%. Scientists from Victoria University of Wellington, the University of Otago, GNS Science, the University of California and the US Geological Survey carried out this research. And with us is Dr. Carolyn Orchardston from Otago University and the science-led project AF8, which is the Alpine Fault Magnitude 8, which is a team of Alpine Fault scientists and emergency practitioners. Dr. Orchardston, welcome.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Talk us through what the research found and how much greater is the risk that we had thought.
Well, yeah, as you say, what we know now is the probability of the next Alpine Fault earthquake has gone up to 75% over the next 50 years. But we already knew that there was a very long record of past earthquakes on the Alpine Fault, and that was from data on the southern end of the fault, where it was discovered 27 earthquakes over the last 8,000 years at those two sites. But what new science is showing us, and it's combining data from lake sediments up on the northern part of the fault, is that we can now sort of extrapolate this long record across a much longer length of the fault, which really just builds the evidence that we need to get better prepared as a society for this future earthquake.
Yeah, David?
I'm just interested in, you know, it's such a precise number, 75% chance. And do we have any numbers for some of the other major fault lines in New Zealand? As a Wellingtonian, I'm very interested in the Wellington numbers. But I seem to recall before the Christchurch earthquakes, they were regarded extremely low probability of major earthquakes in Christchurch. So if we've got one particular fault, which is already at 75% probability, that's certainly concerning.
Well, it is, and we know quite a lot about the active faults. We've got a database of active faults throughout New Zealand, which is managed by GNS Science. And the Wellington fault that you spoke of, I think the probability there is around 10% over the next 50 years. So we're very privileged with the Alpine fault that we have this long record of past earthquake behaviour, because that really helps us understand how it might behave in the future. And we simply don't have that amazing data set for many of the other faults around New Zealand.
Right. Lila, what do you think of this?
The sort of size or the potential size of these earthquakes adds to the picture, I think. I mean,
according
to the at least magnitude 8, 82% probability, 75% chance of a rupture over the next 50 years.
It might make people a little bit nervous, Caroline.
Well, absolutely, and I think it probably should make us all a bit nervous. But I can reassure you that there's quite a lot of work going on across the South Island, and AFA has been in place for about 5 years now, and we've had funding from NEMA, or the National Emergency Management Agency, from the Earthquake Commission, from all of the South Island Civil Defence and Emergency Management Groups to support this endeavour, which is using a scenario-based approach based on an alpine fold earthquake of about magnitude 8 to help us get better prepared to respond to that over the first 7 days after this earthquake happened.
So
there's a lot of work going on.
I was just reading about and picking up on with Lyle Harry an article about this, saying that the earth crust will move metres in a matter of seconds, the ground will shake for several minutes. What the 2016 Kaikoura earthquake was for North Canterbury and Eastern Marlborough, this earthquake will be for much of the South Island. So that gives an example of the magnitude.
That's quite right, yeah. So this is a big, long fault. We'd anticipate most of the damage to be around the Alps, around the Southern Alps region, around where the earthquake begins and ends, along the fault itself. But, of course, this is going to be felt widely across New Zealand, and many of our communities across the South Island are going to be affected by this, either directly or indirectly through things like loss of electricity, communication, and damage to the road network over a period of time.
Just finally, Caroline, how should this information be a wake-up call? What and how should this empower us?
Look, I think over the last few years we've become much more aware of the risks that we face in New Zealand. You know, this is from COVID, from other natural hazard risks. And we're incredibly good at coming together during emergencies these days, you know, and there's a lot that we can do before an event like this to get ourselves and our whānau and our businesses much better prepared than we currently are. So this is a work in progress. We're not going to answer all the questions in terms of preparedness straight away, but we have to start focusing on this over the coming years to make sure that we can respond to this as well as we can as a society.
All right, Dr. Caroline Augustin there from Otago University and the science lead for AF8. Thanks for your time. By the way, that is alpine fault magnitude 8. So what were you saying there, David Farrell? Final thoughts here. This is often top of mind for you when you are in the capital city there and you might sense a shake every so often. You go,
Before the Christchurch shakes, I didn't get upset by shakes in Wellington because they were so common and I'd barely move. But since the Christchurch shakes, I'm now very much in the moment the shaking starts, tense up, lock around, get ready there. So I think, you know, we got quite complacent in Wellington because we were so used to having the fairly low-level shakes.
All right. It is 4:30. You're on the panel. Someone says an interesting fact. I was reading an article in Wired last year, and the Tyrannosaurus rex and the fact they hunt in packs, and there were lots of them, might be scary, but you can, in fact, outrun a Tyrannosaurus rex. Did you know that, Lila?
You can outrun anything, apparently, if you run barefoot. So,
really?
You know, humans were designed for these incredibly long pursuits of these very fast predators.
I did not know that.
And so, yeah, I'm a bit of a fan of these ultra long distance running memoirs, not the actual doing
you
thereof.
You can outrun a T-Rex, David.
I reckon.
Well, it reminds me when I did safari in Africa and the guides told us, look, don't worry, you don't have to be able to outrun a lion, you just have to outrun the slowest member of your party.